Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
My name is Paul Kennelly. I've been lucky enough to have known Glynn for almost 40 years. Somewhat ill-advisedly, he's asked me if I conduct this interview. It's a process I know absolutely nothing about. I haven't got a clue how to do it. So we'll just have to plunge in. But first, just to put you in the picture of quite who we're dealing with here, take just three massively important cultural artifacts. The recordings of You Really Got Me by the Kinks, My Generation by the Who, and Honky Tonk Women by the Rolling Stones. Each one sounding as explosive as a Hezbollah rocket attack. This is the man who recorded those magnificent performances and delivered them to millions of pairs of ears. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. He actually did put lightning in a bottle, and more importantly now, he's put it in a book. So here we are, the legendary Hall of Famer, Glynn Johns.
Oh, thank you, Paul. That's sweet. I've never been likened to a Hezbollah rocket attack before. That's a first.
It was your sound. Right. And it is all about the sound, for me, the book, rather than, you know, the proximity to all these sort of luminaries that you've, you know, just sort of grown up with virtually.
Yeah.
With Glynn, it is always about that pure classic, you know, arguably some of the greatest the greatest recordings ever.
Well, absolutely, I agree.
Glynn, yeah. You were first immersed in music as a child.
I was.
Choir practice.
Yes, exactly. I was in a church choir. Yeah.
And
from
then
the age of eight.
Hearing skiffle and early rock and roll
in
on
my
the
early
radio.
Teens, yeah.
And playing in a little beat group.
Yes, a beat group, yes.
But by the age of 17, you had become an apprentice at
I got a job in a recording studio by a quirk of fate. And I thought, well, it's very interesting. I knew nothing about recording. And I started there, and I thought, well, maybe I could get discovered as a singer. I could use this to meet people in the industry, because I didn't know anybody at all.
Right.
So that was my first interest, was to check out the people in it and what was going on. I knew nothing. I came from the middle of nowhere. And as time went by, I did actually pursue a career as a singer rather inadvisedly. I did get a record deal, and eventually I decided that I couldn't go any further as an engineer. It was a great job, it was fascinating, but in those days, an engineer never progressed to anything else, that was it. You know, the idea of an engineer becoming a producer was just completely unheard of. And equally, there were no freelance engineers, so you worked in the studio, and maybe the best you could achieve would become senior engineer of the studio, or possibly you might even manage the place at the end of the day, which didn't particularly appeal to me. So I set sail. I gave up my job, having done quite well. I'd got a good reputation going as an engineer, and I made a couple of records that just died. I don't know, it was just awful. And I remember sitting at home, having just done a bunch of promotion for this one single I'd done, and I might as well not have bothered leaving the house, really. So I was a bit sort of disparate, and I got a phone call from a producer I'd been working with a lot, a guy called Shel Talmy, who was American, actually. And I'd made a lot of records with him. My Generation was one, in fact, and You Really Got Me, a couple of things with the Kinks. We'd had a lot of success. And I'd been away now for probably 6 weeks or something. And he called me up and he said, well, would you consider coming back? Because it's not quite the same without you, sort of thing. So I said, well, no, I wouldn't. I'm very happy where I am. He said, well, supposing I paid you by the hour, you know. I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So I said, hold on, I'll call you back. And I rang the studio that I used to work for, IBC, and I got the guy who ran the place, and I said, okay, how's business? And he said, well, to be honest with you, since you left, it's dropped off rather a lot. So I went, what would you think if I came back and worked and you paid me by the hour? I was freelance. And there was silence, and he was like, okay, fine. So I worked it. I wasn't particularly bright at school, but I was quite pleased with myself that I'd actually just got two people paying me for the same thing. So, and I became the...
Was the first time
the only freelance engineer for years, strangely. So I did that for a while, and that was great, actually. It was earned a few quid. And things went on, I don't know. That's that story anyway.
Right, and you had been also probably the first person to, when you were still with IBC, to be given the freedom to produce as well. So, there was no such thing as an engineer producer.
There wasn't.
No.
The studio was bought by new owners, and I went to the guy that owned the place that had just bought it, and I said, look, I don't know how old I was 20 maybe, 19, I don't
right.
know.
Right.
And there was a lot, things were beginning to bubble in London. Music was changing, a lot of young people were appearing and rock and roll groups were forming and stuff.
Right.
And I had met a couple of years previously a guy called Ian Stewart who lived locally to me, and he was a really good blues piano player. And he had a fantastic record collection. And he had answered an advertisement that Brian Jones had put in Jazz News or something to form a band, and out of that came the Rolling Stones. It was Stu and Brian that put the band together. So Stu and I by now have become very good friends. In fact, we might have been living together. I had to leave.
Well, he did live with you for a
yes,
while.
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's another story. It's quite funny. So anyway, he told me about the band. I went to see them play, and I'd been given a Jimmy Reed record when I was 16 by an American guy that was visiting with his parents, and I was probably one of the few people in England who'd ever heard Jimmy Reed, and it completely blew me away, and the sound's so fantastic. So when I saw the Rolling Stones, whatever, 3 years later, I knew exactly what they were up to.
Right.
And they were reproducing that sound really well. So in parallel to this, I go and see the guy who now owns the studio, and I said, look, I'm meeting all these acts. I'm sure you've got a studio. They never worked at weekends in those days, so that Saturday and Sunday were free. I said, look, I can bring people in downtime. I just wanted to start doing it. You know?
Right.
So he agreed. He had nothing to lose. The condition was that I had absolutely nothing to do with the business, which may well have been a very good idea. And so the first band I took in with my new arrangement was the Rolling Stones, and it was their first session. Just a complete quirk of fate, really.
Yeah, Diddly Daddy,
yeah,
and Roadrunner.
Exactly. Yeah.
Five rhythm and blues songs.
Yes.
What has happened to those tapes? People have.
Well, actually, I've got an acetate with three of them, and I thought there were only three.
There are
but
five.
While researching the book, I've spent a lot of time on the phone to Bill Wyman, who is absurdly finicky about detail of
yes,
everything.
He is exactly.
I mean, he could tell you what time of day he had a pee on in 1952, which is remarkable. I mean, it sounds funny, but in fact, he's obviously therefore a great source of information. And he says we cut five songs that night, so I guess we did. I don't know. I can't remember.
Right. Well, and also in these weekend sessions, before you actually did the Rolling Stones tracks, you'd had pals like Jimmy Page.
Jimmy Page, who lived in the same town as me also.
Right. Clapton lived around, didn't he?
He did. He lived about 10 miles away, I suppose.
And so. Jeff Beck
Jeff
used to
Beck lived
out.
4 miles away.
Right.
There was something in the water.
Right.
Definitely.
Right.
Yeah. And we all became friends. Stu and I moved into this house. My parents, my father retired, and they moved away. We were all living at home. Much too old to be living at home, really, but anyway, we were. And so I had to find somewhere to live. So I found this little house. It was a bungalow, and it had three bedrooms. That's all I can remember about it, really. And I needed someone to share it with me, because it was far too much money. So the only person I knew that I could even consider living with was Stu, because he was such a lovely guy and a one-off. So I rang him up, and he was older than me, and he was still living with his mum. And I said, "Here, Stu, I've got this house." I told him what the rent was. I said, "Would you fancy coming in?" He said, "Oh, no." He said, no. I get the laundry done, you know, I get my meals cooked. I don't, you know, I can come and go as I like." So I said, "Ah, but Stu, can you take girls home?" And he went, "Okay, I'm in," he said. And the condition was that no domesticity. He refused to clean anything or have anything to do with the garden. And I went, "Okay, that's fine." And he turned up with his upright piano. That was it. He arrived with his piano.
Yeah.
So we had the third bedroom, and we thought we'd invite someone else. And he had a friend who actually I didn't really like. He was an insipid bloke, really. Anyway, that's now the end of the day. His name was Brian. So Brian worked for an advertising agency. Stu's off with the Stones now. The Stones are really happening. I'm rocking, working 24 hours a day in the studio. Having a great time, not complaining. And Brian is going to work on the train and coming back as an advertising agency, and he gets jealous. So he decides he wants to be a musician. So he learns how to play the harmonica. Does anybody in here play the harmonica? I believe it's quite easy. I've never actually tried. But it must be, actually, because otherwise he'd never have been able to do it. Stu's such a lovely guy. He decided to help Brian put this band together. So they go to a club called on Il Pie Island. I can't remember what it was called now. Doesn't matter. Which is a little island in the middle of the Thames. And it was very popular, and everybody played there in those days. So they go along, and they see this band called the Tridents. And Jeff Beck happens to be in the Tridents. So Stu, everybody knows who Stu is, because he's in the Stones.
Right.
Comes off stage. "This is my mate, Brian. He's putting a band together. You in?" Jeff goes, "Well, Jeff wouldn't know the blues if he fell over him, actually, if you think about it." Well, certainly not then. But anyway, he joins the band because of Stu.
Right.
And I'm told about all this, and I don't give a monkey. I'm not interested. So eventually, they do their first gig, and it's on a Sunday afternoon, never forget, it's on a Sunday afternoon in a little folk club. And I couldn't get out of going, I had to go really, it would have been mean not to. So I go along thinking this is going to be terrible. And actually it was, except this bloke playing the guitar who I've never heard of. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like it. He, as we all know, he's just extraordinary. So I marked his card. He obviously became pals with us. And Jimmy living up there. So there was a crowd of us that would hang out, but we were the only place that they were still living with their mum and dad, I think, you know.
Right.
So all the naughty stuff went on at my place.
Yeah. Well, then, the next, and I must say, in the book, I think you remarked on Jeff Beck's oily mechanic.
Well, yeah, he
fingers.
Was a car freak, he still is, yeah. Actually. And whenever you saw him, he was ingrained black oil in his hands. Disgusting.
Well, I'm going to refer to my copious, I've got screeds.
Well, get on with it
here.
Then.
Yes, I know. Well, you're already very much ahead of where.
Oh, well, you want
to No. All right, well, let's plumb for this one. Let's see. Yeah, and I have to keep doing this because my eyesight is somewhat akin to that of blind Pew. So, yes, we left IBC.
We've moved on, yeah.
Yes, to pursue a certain, yes. Okay. But actually, it was around this time, I think, that you met Andrew Oldham and also started working at Olympic. Is that right?
Yes, actually, yeah. The sessions with the Stones that I did, nothing came of that because the gentleman that I'd done the arrangement with, had the arrangement, the owner of the studio, turned out to be totally incompetent as far as selling anything. He didn't know anybody in the industry, really, it turned out, other than some guy at Decca who did classical music. So he took the Rolling Stones tape to him,
right.
Quite understandably. He didn't quite get it, so they got turned down. Right. A week after those sessions, Andrew Oldham met the Rolling Stones, and he had a partner called Eric Easton, who was an agent, and he approached them and said, "I'd like to manage you." And they said, "That's great, we're up for that." And Andrew said, "Well, have you committed yourself to anything?" They said, "Well, we've got this arrangement with IBC and Glyn Johns." Right. So Andrew said, "Well, go and get out of it." So right. They went. I was coming back from lunch one day out of the front of the building with the Rolling Stones. I said, "What are you doing here?" And they said, "Well, we just got out of the contract. We don't want to do it. We decided we don't want to be commercial. We don't want to..." Lying toads. Anyway, so I went loopy. I mean, don't forget, I was one of the few people on the planet who even knew they existed. But right. I knew that there was something was going on there. You know, so they were going to be huge. So I was really upset because they were traitored on me, really. But I didn't really blame them. So I went steaming into the building and had a terrible go at this bloke. I nearly got I was already freelance. No, I wasn't. I was working for him, so I nearly got the sack. Anyway, Andrew Alden then took them into a studio and cut the first single, and he did it identically to how I'd done it. Andrew Alden couldn't produce an apple and an orange. He couldn't whistle a tune. I mean, he's a completely non-musical person, I thought. And anyway, I was mad as hell. And they went off, and the first single was released, huge hit. I still saw the guys. I used to go to gigs with them in the van and everything, but I wouldn't have anything to do with Andrew Alden. And so a year later, they're now hitting it big time. A year later, I'm working in the studio, freelance, and the phone rings, and it's the girl in the booking office. And she says, Glyn, look, would you do us a favour? After your session finishes tonight at 11 o'clock, we've got a new client who we'd really like to encourage to use the studio, and he wants to come in tonight. But none of our engineers are here. You're the only person left in the building. Would you do us a favour and stay on and do the session? So I said, oh, well, who is it? And then she said, Andrew Alden. So I said, oh, you've got to be joking. I don't want to have anything to do with him. But I really liked this girl. I had a big crush on her. She was gorgeous. She looked like Jane Russell. Stunning. Oh, lovely. Anyway, so she used her female wily ways, and I gave in very quickly, actually. So Andrew Alden knocks on the door at 11 o'clock at night. I open the door. I say, come in, sit down, we'll get on with it. It was a vocal overdub. So we do it. I'm not going to speak to him. I just do the job. Really, I hate him. So we get to the end of the session, and he said, what did you think of the track? So I said, it was okay. It wasn't awful, you know. I wasn't going to tell him it was good, which it actually was. So he said, well, hold on a minute. So he goes to the phone. It's now 1 o'clock in the morning, and he rings his secretary, wakes her up, says, put the last three singles he'd done, in a cab and send them to IBC. I had to sit there and wait for these bloody singles to come. Put them on the turntable, and actually they were really good. So I had to sort of edit. He said, okay, now what do you think? And I said, okay, all right, okay, yes, you do know what you're doing. They're very, very good. So he said, right, well, will you come and work with me now? So I said, yes. Now, if I hadn't fancied this bird, I would never have worked with the Rolling Stones again. And that's, I then started working with them and worked with them for the next 13 years, which, as you can imagine, was not bad for my career, really. Obviously, I was doing a lot of other stuff as well, but it was a nice thing to have on your CV.
Right, and also you were actually doing all the artists on Andrew Alden's label immediately.
Exactly, so it was a lot of work. Yeah.
The Small Faces, the loudest singles ever made in Britain.
Does anybody know about Small Faces? Yeah, they never came here. It's ridiculous that they never came here. It's so sad, actually, because they'd have ruled the country without any question. They were absolutely extraordinary. They were only about that big. And made the biggest noise you've ever seen, more energy than anything you've ever seen. Just quite extraordinary. Great bunch of guys. And I made pretty much everything as an engineer. They produced themselves, mostly. Which really meant I did most of it, but I didn't mind. It was wonderful.
Who else was on them? Chris Farlow, The Move. You were doing all that stuff.
Yes.
Marianne Faithfull, right?
Marianne Faithfull, yes. Yes. First session I ever did at Olympic was with Marianne Faithfull.
Right.
Yeah.
The Olympic, which of course became your home from home. I'm looking once more at these things. The notes, incidentally, are marginally shorter than the book itself. yes. And of course, at this time, although you had stopped making records yourself as an artist and sort of forgotten about that, you got a massive hit in Spain.
I know. That's another funny story.
Lady Jane. Yes.
I'd cut the song Lady Jane with the Rolling Stones. And it was a ballad, so therefore quite simple to sing. And I cut it as a single, myself, with a string quartet. And Brian Jones played sitar, and John Mark played acoustic Spanish guitar. It was really good. Right. It's a great little arrangement. Done by Tony Meehan, who was in The Shadows.
Right.
The drummer in The Shadows.
Yes.
And he produced the record. So we cut this, and I didn't have a record deal, I don't think, at the time. So Tony paid for the session. And we were really pleased with it. And then 2 days later, we found out that someone else had covered it, and they got this show. Used to be a weekly TV show in England called Ready, Steady, Go. And if you got Ready, Steady, Go, you had a hit, basically, because it was the music programme along with Top of the Pops. So there was no point in us even trying to get it released, because this other bloke had already beaten us to it. So I had an acetate of it, and I had it in my briefcase. It was sort of lived in my briefcase. In parallel to that, Bill Wyman and I formed a company. It's a very loose term for what we were doing, but it was a production company. And Bill had found a couple of bands, and we'd make recordings of them, and he actually did much more to do with getting in gigs. I was too busy doing other things. Anyway, we had this band called The End, very aptly named, and we couldn't
Peter
get them.
Peter Frampton, was it?
No, Peter Frampton was in The Hurt.
Oh, right. That was another band. Right.
So The End, we couldn't get them arrested in England, so one of them knew somebody in Spain, some woman who knew these two brothers who owned this massive company in Spain called Sonoplay, and they owned billboards and they were a publishing outfit, very wealthy, and they decided that they wanted to go into the music. It's a bit of a long story, this, sorry. Stop me if I waffle on, or if I nod off. You won't have to stop me, will you? So I'm told to go to Spain and meet with these guys to sell The End's record, right? Because apparently they're interested. So I jump on a plane and I go over there and play them the record, and they're very pleased. And obviously part of the deal was that Bill Wyman from the Rolling Stones would go over and help promotion. Because
right.
No, the Stones had never actually been to Spain at that moment in time. So as I'm leaving, the guy says to me, have you got anything else? And I've got my little briefcase. And I thought, oh. So I pulled out the acetate of my version of Lady Jane, and I give it to him. I didn't say it was me. I said, well, I've got this. So he put it on. He said, oh, this is great. We love this. So I then had to own up it was me. And they asked me to sign a contract there and then. And I signed my name, Glyn T. Jones. My middle initial is T. And when the record came out...
Thomas.
Oh, yeah, Thomas. Yeah. So when the record came out, however long later, I was called Glint Johns, which was quite funny. Anyway, didn't seem to make any difference. So anyway, I go back to England. I'm very pleased with myself. They'd given me a check for a small amount of money that would cover the cost of the session. So I give that to Tony Meehan, and at least I feel debt-free with Tony. And we carry on. And a few weeks later, The End go to Spain. And they start touring to promote their record. And then Bill and I jump on a plane and go out. And there's another story which is in the book, so I won't tell you that bit. But anyway, we get off the plane, and it's just like, I don't know if you've ever seen that thing with the Beatles at Shea Stadium. You know, so the Beatles, when they first came to America, there's people and the kids on the roof and,
right.
You know, mayhem everywhere. And in those days, they didn't have chutes off the plane. You had to go downstairs and walk across the tarmac. So we pull up at Madrid Airport, and it's complete lunacy. I mean, it's Bill's coming, he's one of the Rolling Stones. So there's about 50 cameramen, TV, movies, kids on the roof screaming and all the usual stuff. So I get out of the way. I get off the plane first and I walk down under the wing to get out of the way, and Bill follows me down. And the whole press corps follow me under the bloody wing. So the guy from the record company, I can see him at the back of the crowd. I go, wait, tell this lot they're taking... I've had long hair, you know. They're taking pictures of the wrong bloke. Bill's coming down the bloody stairs now. He goes, no, your record's number one. It had been, seriously, I swear. I mean, I had no idea it had even been released. And actually, to be fair, number one in Spain means you probably sold four records, so it wouldn't mean an awful lot. And well, to be honest, I also don't know which chart he was talking about. I'm not sure it was anything particular.
No, I think it
well,
was
anyway,
bigger than
that's
that
story. Right, next.
Yes, because I've had a copy of it. I gave it to your boy, Ethan.
Yes. And he's been holding it against me ever since.
Yeah, I'm sure he's teased you mercilessly. Actually, talking about mobs of girls, it's not in the book or anything, but I remember you telling me about being with the Stones in Poland and being rather unnerved.
Oh, that was in Ireland.
Oh, was it Ireland?
Yeah. It ends with land. Exactly. Yeah. That was extraordinary.
Where they were on the roof.
This is quite early on in the 60s. They were huge, and they were doing a tour of Ireland, which doesn't take terribly long. And I was asked to go along with Peter Whitehead, who was a documentary filmmaker, and be the sound man of the two-man crew, basically.
Right.
To make a documentary about them in Ireland, which actually is used on that thing that Andrew Oldham just released, Charlie Is My Darling, I think it's called.
Right.
That's what it's all about. Yeah. It's a DVD that Andrew Oldham just released. Anyway, so we do this, they do a concert in a cinema in I think it must have been Belfast. And the deal was, you come off stage, and there was a door into an alleyway alongside the theatre, and there was supposed to be the cars were supposed to be parked in it. And so we opened the doors, where they could rush off stage, there's mayhem going on in the auditorium. And they'd done two shows, and the people from the first show were still in the street outside waiting for them. Anyway, there's this alleyway down the side of the building where the cars are supposed to be. We could all go outside, and there's no cars, and the door's shut behind us, you can't get in.
Right.
And so it was pretty weird. So we had to go towards this raging crowd and fight our way to the cars that were on the other side of the street. And eventually, I'm connected to the cameraman with a sync lead, so... And we were getting pushed and shoved. It was just mayhem. And eventually we got in the car. Well, I was just about to get in the car and I felt this huge whack across my back.
Right.
I'd been shillelied by a policeman. Well, I had no idea who it was, but I had a stick mic about that long. And my instinct was... Yeah. Right, yeah. So, and I laid this copper out. I mean, I thought, oh, God, now I'm really in trouble. And there's kids climbing all over the cars. And we got in the car... There's two cars instead of four or whatever they were supposed to be. So we're all sitting on each other's laps. And these kids pushed the cars sideways across the street and the wheels of the car collapsed underneath. I mean, it was just very frightening, actually.
I know really it was harrowing.
Yeah, harrowing is a very good word, yes.
Told me. Glyno, we better sort of...
Move on swiftly.
Yes, because I've got a feeling that we were only given... 35 minutes. Let's see. We'll just have to skip. Let's see. Oh, well, no, this is sort of somewhat important, I suppose. The first Led Zeppelin album, which not just for the fact that the world was introduced to Led Zeppelin, but this is when you changed how all records, all records were recorded and mixed in stereo. This is the first example of, Glyn obviously doesn't know this, where the snare drum and the bass drum are in the center and he's got the...
You're talking about stereo drums, not the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. But that really
I discovered
did
stereo,
yeah.
Stereo drum like it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it. I mean, I could go on about that. But, you know, I'll bore you.
Yeah, but
I could bore you rigid about it.
Up until that moment, drums were always on the right or the left
hand
side.
Well, in the middle, really. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I thought it was rather important.
No, it's okay. A lot of people think it's important.
Oh, the next one.
No,
hold on.
Okay. Let's just talk about Led Zeppelin for a minute.
Right.
Because that's, I think you might be interested. Obviously, phenomenal. I'm sure you all remember hearing the first Led Zeppelin. Some of you perhaps are too young, but the first Led Zeppelin album when it came out, and I'm sure it had a huge effect on you because you probably, well, you hadn't heard anything quite like it. So I'd known Jimmy since we were kids. I'd known John Paul Jones since I was probably 19. Session bass player. I saw him every day. Really good friends. Time goes by. Jimmy joins the Yardbirds, as does Jeff Beck, interestingly, which I always thought was a bit odd. Anyway, there we are. And I didn't see very much of him. I was very busy running around like a, what's it? And I get a call out of the blue from Jimmy saying, I've put a band together and I'm going to make an album with them. And John and I would love you to do it. So I went, oh, well, that sounds great. You know? Well, I know that they're wonderful musicians. Jimmy Page, renowned guitar player. So I turn up because it's a couple of mates. You know, I had no idea, not a clue what I was walking into. And you could imagine... Hearing them play for the first time, the first eight bars, I thought I'd died and gone. It was just extraordinary. I mean, huge sound, incredible arrangements. The drummer I'd never heard of, John Bonham, and I'd never heard of Robert Plant either. Both equally as good as everybody else. So the combination of the four was just remarkable. Well, we all know that. But selfishly, from my point of view, can you imagine sitting there and watching this going on? It was just extraordinary. We made that record in 9 days. I mean, because they were so proficient, you know, it was really quick. So, yes, possibly one of the better sounding records I ever made, certainly from the point of view of rock and roll. Another example of that would be the first Eagles album, which I still get tingles when I listen to. And I've got extremely fond memories of making. In fact, one of the eagles is here tonight.
Yes, we have an eagle.
We have an eagle and an owl. Bernie Ledden is here. Where are you, Bern? Where are you, Bern? Yeah, there he is. Somehow or other, we've managed to remain extraordinarily good friends ever since. But again, another experience of, obviously I knew what they were capable of when we went in because I decided to work with them. So it was a slightly different story. However, to be honest, and it's not just because he's here, but the most important ingredient sonically for me was Bernie because of his extraordinary ability as an acoustic guitar player. And what a guitar player altogether, but he does have the most extraordinary collection of instruments on the one hand, and he gets the most remarkable sound out of them. And my whole thing has always been, from the very beginning until today, my job is, without any question, to be of service to the artist and to capture what they're giving me, not to create something totally unrealistic out of what's being fed through from the studio, which is what happens now with most people. With contemporary sound, it would seem that a guitar sounding really nice isn't any good anymore. So my whole thing is, I've been really fortunate to work with some wonderful musicians, and they all create a fantastic sound that's individual to them. And my job is to capture that, which can be quite difficult, but equally, that's the most important thing. It isn't for me to start changing them and trying to make them sound better. It's for me to, the difficulty is to make them sound as good as they really are. And the Eagles were a classic example of where that suited my style of recording initially. It didn't suit them after two or three albums. They got tired of it and went off and did something else. That worked for them really well also. But that's the way I've always seen it. And it's also a much simpler way of doing what I do because I don't have to use my brain, you know.
And I have to say, it's quite remarkable. When you walk in from the studio having been playing on something that Glenn's recording, you go into the control room, and right there and then the playback, no tarting up or anything, sounds.
Well, that's the other thing.
Like the record.
The contemporary way of recording now, and this has been the case for a long time, on the very rare occasion that I visit other people's sessions, I notice that, particularly with Pro Tools, no one ever rides anything when it's going down. Everything's left till later.
Right.
No one can possibly make a decision at the time.
Right.
And there are many reasons why I think that's wrong, but I could bore you all night. But
well, you used to mix off the monitor section.
Yes, I did. Yeah. But the way I was taught when I started, everything was mono, and you had to make a decision as you went along because there was no afterwards.
Right.
There's a lot to be gained from that. Because there's no prevarication. You don't, you know, you make a decision and you have to stick by it. And so you don't get hung up. You know, they say about golf is, it's all in the brain and all the rest. Well, it's the same thing with recording. The more opportunities you get to postpone making a decision, the worse it gets. And the longer you'll take, and the less likely you are to react to something positively or negatively or whatever else in the cold light of day, if you like.
Right.
It's terribly difficult to explain, but I'm sure you know what I mean. Do you know what I mean?
Good.
I feel so strongly about this.
Yeah.
When I'm putting a basic track down, I'm riding everything as it's going down. And so when I play it back, there's a fairly good representation of the way it's going to be mixed there and then. I used to print echo on the drums or whatever. I'd actually give the guys in their earphones the sonic picture that would hopefully the thing would end up with. And again, the musicians would then play to that sound, and it does make a hell of a difference. And obviously, they'd be creating it in the first place. I'd just be dicking with it, you know. And I think, again, that's incredibly important. And a lot of that doesn't ever go on now, particularly with a vocal.
Right.
If you actually ride it while it's going down, it's not that complicated. Once you've heard it through, once you know pretty much what the dynamics are going to be.
It's not for you.
I mean, I mix an album easily in 3 days, and I don't use a computer, and that's another thing. I hate computers, not in the normal sense, but as in a recording process. To me, a mix is a performance, just like anything else. And the thing about performances is that they vary, and you actually can make a mistake that's beneficial, and I do that all the time. And if you pre-program everything, that'll never happen again. It's just, it takes away part of the creative process, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Well, that's what sort of makes you the artist that you are. I mean, actually, you really got me, or my generation, are perfect examples of that, because that was actually it.
They were three-track, probably, in those days, but yeah. so there was a mix afterwards. But I think it's really sad that the norm now is the contemporary way of recording, which, of course, can be used brilliantly, and great records are made, and all this. I don't want to sound like a boring old fart too much, but I do respect that. Some great records have been made, but I pray that the way I was taught to work won't disappear. If you consider the recording process was initially designed to capture the performance of a piece of music, that's all it was for. So people performed, they reacted when they played, emotionally to each other, and therefore affected the feel of the piece of music they were playing, whether it's classical or any or whatever, rock and roll. I was going to say punk, but that was a bit over the top, really. Now the recording process has completely reversed the whole thing. The method of recording affects the way the song's written in the first place, in many cases, and it certainly affects the way it's played. If you record, let's say you record a bass, drums, and a rhythm guitar as a basic track, and then you overdub three or four other instruments and a vocal, strings, or whatever else. The three guys that put the basic track down will obviously instinctively react to each other, and that's cool. The guy that's going to do the overdub is being influenced by what they play and will react to it. However, they're not going to react at all to what he's done. And the same with the next, and the same with the next. Now, you might think that might matter, and in a lot of cases, perhaps it doesn't. However, I hope there's a few musicians in here tonight, and I'm sure you'll identify with what I'm saying, and some of you might disagree. But there's a subconscious thing that happens when you play live. You don't think about it, you're not even necessarily aware of it. But when a piece of music is performed, there's a particularly wonderful performance of it, it is as a result of that combination of people playing a piece of music and reacting off each other emotionally. Right. Music is about emotions, playing it and listening to it, if you think about it. And the reason why everything is so clinical now, in my view, not just the digital awfulness, but the fact that the emotion is being taken out of music in the way I've just described, in varying degrees.
Right.
So there you go. I hope somebody agrees with that. And yeah, good.
That was really instilled in you from even, you know, from when you were in the choir.
Well yeah, precisely, yeah.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, the studio I worked at, we had a remote unit that was literally the equipment could be taken out of the studio and you put it in a remote furniture removal truck and you take it to a big venue and record the London Symphony Orchestra or whatever. And so I watched all that going on, and you see that, and you can't beat it, can you? I mean, it's just astonishing.
Fantastic.
It's just astonishing.
We've got to move on, Glenn.
Sorry, Paul.
They'll be shooing us off. The next thing, the Beatles. Well, that's not very interesting. We can skip there. but, you know, although your Let It Be album mixes weren't released... Your mix of Let It Be and Get Back were. And in actual fact, you were responsible for the rooftop performance, weren't you?
Yeah, it was Ringo and I came up with it. I think it was probably my idea, but certainly Ringo took me up on the roof and showed me the roof. And we had a bit of a problem. Paul's original idea for Let It Be, perhaps if you all know, is a very good idea, actually. No one else has ever done it. Was to write a bunch of songs and record them live in front of an audience as a show. So it would be a live album of new material. I suppose there aren't that many artists that can get away with that, really, but they could. It's slightly different. Anyway, so it was the middle of winter, and his idea was to go to Tunisia. There was some Roman amphitheatre in Tunisia or something, which obviously still exists. And he wanted to go there. He wanted to get a bunch of Beatles fans, stick them on a boat, take them to Tunis. It's a bit expensive. And have them as an audience. And it would be a TV show. And the making of that whole process was to be a documentary. So we'd started on the soundstage at Chickenham Film Studios, rehearsing the material. And by the time, I don't know, 3 or 4 days later, every time we had a tea break or whatever, we'd discuss what was going to go on and what wasn't. And eventually it became apparent that the idea of going to Africa wasn't a flyer. Ringo said he wouldn't like the food. I seem to remember that, which I thought was quite funny. They're spending hundreds of thousands of pounds moving people around, and they couldn't afford a chef to cook eggs and chips for Ringo. So the whole idea sort of got blown apart. And here we are, we've got great songs being rehearsed. We've got a documentary film being made, but now we've got no end. So we decided to move into their office building. They just built a recording studio in the basement that was finished in the weeks that we were in on the soundstage. So we moved in there, carried on rehearsing, film crew, and I witnessed, during this process, something that I knew hundreds of thousands of people would love to be a fly on the wall for, which was these four guys sitting around playing live and joking and taking the mickey out of each other. With some of the time with Billy Preston, who'd called by and was asked to stay. And I thought, this is just remarkable. Now, at this point, don't forget, it's again, we're casting back. Cast back your mind to 1969. The Beatles are the biggest thing on there. They couldn't go anywhere, and they were huge, huge. They were on a monolith up here somewhere. And they'd already proven they'd made the most stunning produced records. They'd changed the rules. They'd just extraordinary stuff. And here they are, right back at the beginning, sitting around playing live. And it was great. It was even more great because they were who they were, obviously, and they'd achieved what they'd achieved. And I thought, God, this is fantastic. So I was recording everything and I'm playing so that they could see how they were getting on with the arrangements and everything. Anyway, one night I snuck away with the multitracks, went to Olympic and mixed everything we'd done that day and edited it together with a bit of chat and a false start here and somebody being rude to somebody else there. But all
and
in good.
Save the last dance for me.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff. Yeah. So, and I thought it was really funny and I thought it was fantastic because it was showing who they really were. And so I took it in the next morning and I played it to them. And to a man, they went, oh, don't be ridiculous, you know, they don't want anything to do with that. And I kind of expected that. So we carried on and we won't go on about the end of that, but we got to the end, we shot it, we did the thing on the roof, and then they went away to edit the film. And the guy who directed the documentary was a TV director, and he hadn't really paid attention, wasn't used to working with film. So it took a year for that film to be finished because there was no continuity, it was a complete mess. And so we carried on and we started Abbey Road, what was to become Abbey Road, while I was just doing sessions.
Yeah. Right.
And then we kept taking breaks and I got busy. I went off and did stuff here with Steve Miller and various people, I can't remember. Right. And in the end, they went back into Abbey Road with George Martin and Jeff Emmerich, their engineer, and finished Abbey Road. And actually, this will sound like I'm being immodest, but in fact, I'm really glad they did because it's what they did really was fantastic. I don't really remember what I did on that record. I did some of it,
right?
Maybe a third of it or something. But it...
Yeah, because they had asked for you to come back from somewhere.
So then we finished Abbey Road. A period of time goes by and I get a call from John and Paul. They asked me to meet them at Abbey Road. So I jump in the car and go up there. I walk in the control room and there's a pile of multitrack tapes. And they said, do you remember that idea that you had made us acetates on? So I said, yeah. So they said, well, we think that's probably the best way to do the record. And we'd like you to do it. I went, well, that's fantastic, great. So I said, well, when do we start? And they said, well, we don't start. You're going to do it on your own like you did before. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. They've got all this confidence in me to go away and do this without them there. And in the car on the way home, I thought, hold on a minute. I realized it wasn't anything to do with that. They were bored rigid with it and they weren't interested in it anymore. They'd lost interest. So they were quite happy to just give it to me to go away and do, which was a bit disappointing, really. So it did get finished and I did deliver it back to EMI. And then the band broke up, and it's well before it ever was talked about even being released. By now, Abbey Road's sort of well on the way. And then John Lennon came to America and formed a relationship with Phil Spector, which I always thought was a really, really strange combination of people. And he gave the tapes to Phil Spector, and who puked all over the bloody lot of them. And just awful, awful record now. I think.
Well, it is a great loss because those mixes were fantastic.
Well, it is available on a bootleg, apparently. But that's not the end of it. Yeah.
I'm not responsible for it, but I do.
Oh, you
have
do have
a copy of it.
Right.
Because Glyn was, you were mucking around in the boot of your car. You were emptying the boot of your car.
And I
you
found.
Came across this mildewed tape box.
It was a 7.5 copy of my version of Let It Be, yeah.
Yeah.
That had been under the mat in my Bentley for God knows how long. It was covered in green mildew, exactly right, yeah. Anyway, there we are.
Yes, well, you know. Good man. I mean, if anybody has a chance to get that bootleg, don't tell Glyn about it, but listen to it. It's really good. It's really good because it's like a diary entry. Right. Yes, well, we've done Abbey Road, all that nonsense. Let's see. And then you started this enduring relationship with A&M Records, beginning with the Ozark Mountain Dead.
One of whom is here. Soup, where are you? Soup. Announce yourself. There he is.
There we are.
The bass player from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. A true gentleman. And a wonderful musician, actually. Ozark, are you familiar with the Ozark Mountain? I'm sure you all are. Of course you are.
Yeah.
Fantastic band. Fantastic band. I lucked out there. I had a very dear friend in LA called David Andley, who actually worked for A&M. And we were really good mates. And every time I went to LA, I'd very often stay with him. And I arrived one day and he said, I've just been sent this tape by a mutual friend of ours, who's his lawyer, in fact, a guy called Abe Summer. And he said, you should hear it, it's really good. And he played me these demos of the Ozark Mountain Dead. I was like, wow, that's fantastic. He said, well, we're gonna sign them, I think. So I said, well, you can't have them. I tell you what, can I co-produce? It's the only time I've ever co-produced, in those days anyway. And he agreed. And so we actually co-produced this record together, which was great fun for us. And actually, probably a good job because he provided a completely different service to me. He was much nicer than me, basically. But we had such fun. We made two albums, one in England, and then the second one in the Ozark Mountains. And we had a huge hit with Jackie Blue. And I remember that really well, and I have very dear and fond memories. Great musicians, great harmonies. That's something I'd like to talk about very briefly, actually. That this is really interesting. I've never really thought about it before, but I've always loved harmony because I was in a choir from the age of 8, obviously, so it's a bit of an influence. If you take the Eagles or the Beatles or the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, for that matter, and you break down the four voices or the three voices that form that extraordinary sound that's completely peculiar to them, those voices are entirely different from each other. I mean, remarkably different. If you listen, if you think about it, if you've heard Don Henley sing, for example, or you've heard Bernie sing, they're like chalk and cheese. And you would never think for a second that combining them together would really work. And maybe if two of them sing, it doesn't work that particularly well. But with four of them, the Eagles' vocal sound was just astonishing. And the same with the Beatles. George Harrison's voice is completely different from John's, which is completely different from Paul's. But the combination of the three, absolutely astonishing. And the Ozark Mountain Dead was the same thing. Great singers in the band, put them all together and you get a magic sound.
Yeah, the blend.
There you go. Right.
Well, I tell you, it is exhausting to think about the your sort of tireless non-stop schedule. I'm looking here. During that time, obviously you were continuing doing all the Stones albums, but you were doing Joe Cocker, Leon Russell, Humble Pie.
Bit of a mistake, that.
What, Humble Pie?
Yes.
Well, it was loud.
It was very loud and boring, quite boring, really.
And you were sort of constantly adapting adapting with how, you know, the changes that were coming along in the technology.
Well, you didn't have much choice, really.
Yeah. Yes, but I do know this, that when you got to 16 track, you were loath to go to 24 track because you said the head width.
it was quite a dramatic change.
Yeah,
I mean, I did get used to it in the end, but I now record 16 track again.
Yeah, no, well, good for you. And that's why.
In fact, the first 16 track thing I ever did was Stage Fright. I mixed Stage Fright, the band's album Stage Fright. And I mean, I've never had so many faders in a mix. And I didn't know the material either, and there was nobody there. They just sent me the tape. Wow, that was fantastic. I mean, what a great band.
It's not mentioned in the book, but the band being the way they were, paid him all individually, didn't they? They said, yes, I remember you telling me that five
I probably
checks.
Made it up. I don't remember that. I don't remember
no,
that.
No. Paul no, and I remember all
Paul and I eventually became incredibly close to Levon, who I'm sure everybody in this room feels the same way about. I mean, what an amazing musician. And in parallel with that, the most remarkable man. Paul and I made a record together with Jesse James. It was called The Legend of Jesse James. And Levon played Jesse James. Everyone was cast. Johnny Cash played Frank James. Levon played. And we spent however long it took us to make the record. We all lived in the same house. And it was just a joy to be with him. And we'd stay up very late every night. And he tells stories, smoking his Camel cigarettes. I don't know what he died of in the end, but I'm sure it must have been throat cancer.
Yeah, it was cancer. Yeah.
But a fantastic guy to work with. I mean, how you can sing and play the drums like that at the same time, I've got no idea. Henley, of course, is quite capable of doing that as well. But I think Levon was particularly special, and I'm interrupting you from your next question.
No, not at all. This is the whole point. We've got you talking. Stage fright. What else is here? Rita Coolidge, The Faces, Traffic, Graham Nash, is an innumerable catalogue of things. Neil Young. It's around this time you started your tenure with The Who. Just tell them about recording Won't Get Fooled Again.
Quite remarkable. I got sent the demos. I'd met Pete very early on. I had a little semi-pro band, a cover band, and we were on the same circuit as The Who. They were called The High Numbers then, which is when we were kids. And on that occasion, we'd be on the same bill, and we'd watch them, and they'd stay and watch us. And so Pete and I became pals. Go forward a bit. I'm working with Shel Talmy. He says we've got a session with a band called The Who, and it's Pete. And what were The High Numbers? They come in my generation. So it was great. They're a bunch of mates. So time goes by. Kit Lambert, that was their manager, and he produced them for a while. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I don't know what year it was, but it's moving on a bit, I get a call from Pete, and he asks me if I produce the next album. Sends me demos of what becomes Who's Next, which were phenomenal. I mean, he made, you probably all know this because they get released every now and then. He made fantastic demos. He's a great engineer. I mean, the fact that he created the synthesizer parts for Barbara O'Reilly and Won't Get Fooled Again in his own studio with an ARP synthesizer which looked like a telephone exchange. How he figured that out, I've got no idea. I mean, I wouldn't be able to figure it out. I mean, in fact, Mick Jagger got sent to Moog shortly thereafter, and he rang me up and he said, here, get your ass around to my place. He said, I've just been given this Moog, I haven't got a bloody clue how it works. And I said, well, I won't have a clue. Anyway, I went round there and I looked at it, it was in a box. We got it. Right. I thought, I don't know. It's Chinese to me, mate. You need Mr. Moog. He's given it to you. He can tell you how to work it. So I went home. Anyway, so all very, very thrilling. The demos are amazing. But obviously, you can imagine, Pete had played everything on the demo, so it didn't sound like The Who. It sounded like Pete. So we all have a meeting. There's a movie script with this. It's a movie. It's a soundtrack to a movie. And he sent me the script. It's called Lifehouse. And he sent the other guys in the band a script. And we all had a meeting. And we're talking about how we're going to do this, how the movie's going to be made. Da, 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 da. And I was the first, unfortunately, it's a bit embarrassing, really. I was the first person in the room to say, well, to be honest with you, I don't really understand this script. I saw it as my fault, but I really didn't understand what the hell it was about, really. I didn't get it. And I was saying that to ask him to explain, because I saw it as my fault. And it went round the room. Everybody said, well, actually, I don't understand it either. So it was a bit like the King of War No Clothes. You know, no one actually had the bottle to tell him that we didn't know, except Muggins here, who's had the blame ever since for why the film never got made. So within 30 seconds, the whole idea of the film was out the back door. So it was very embarrassing. And so I said, well, listen, the songs are fantastic. Never mind about the film. We should just go in and make an album. Okay. So it's the next step, we go and make the record. Pete says to me, I just done some stuff at Stargroves. Mick Jagger had this house in the country in England. It was a sort of Victorian pile.
Edwardian,
okay. It was extremely ugly house. Neither here nor there. Yeah. It had a huge entrance hall with sort of double height ceiling. And the Stones and I had cut some stuff down there. It worked really well. But this time the Rolling Stones had built their own mobile recording unit. So it's the first time I was involved in designing it. In fact, it was the first time we'd ever had the equipment built into something rather than having to take it in.
Because you were involved with Helios consoles as well.
I was. I persuaded Chris Blackwell to invest in a technician that used to do all the equipment for Olympic called Dick Swetnam. He was a genius. And we started Helios. That was for Basing Street Studios that Chris built.
You designed.
So Pete says to me, I hear you've been working down at Stargroves with the Stones. Did it work? And I said, yes, it was really good. He said, well, maybe we should go down there. So Won't Get Fooled Again was cut in Mix Hall.
Right.
And the astonishing thing about it, and I'm sure you all know this, because they do it on stage now, it's exactly the same. They played to the synthesizer, right? Which is, it's very rigid time, obviously. In those days, no one ever used a click. It was unheard of, and actually, I banned them. I won't have anything to do with it. It's got nothing to do with music. So, if there's any drummers in here, they'll know. It's incredibly difficult to stay in time with a click if you're a drummer, particularly if you've never done it before. So, Keith Moon and the others played as a group to the synthesizer. I stole the synth off Pete's demos, edited it a bit because it was a bit long, and I played it into them, and they played just like they were on stage. It was, and they never lost time with the track for a split second. And to play with that energy and to stay in time with a piece of machinery, I think it's just extraordinary. And I remember sitting outside in the truck because I couldn't see them. I was outside. Mm. I had a little black and white monitor about that big. The Stones were very mean. Well, Mick Jagger's very mean, actually. Little pity little thing. So I couldn't really see what was going on in there, but I was hearing this huge sound coming out. I mean, I can remember it as clear as anything.
Right,
so
but you
exciting,
were responsible
so
for the huge sound.
No. That is completely and utterly wrong. Bless your heart. I could not disagree with you more. I have never been responsible. Paul, think back to what I was saying just now. They were giving me that sound. All I was doing was recording it.
I know, but you did record it. Yes. Correctly. And it's an oak panelled hallway, that, isn't it?
I don't remember the oak panels. It's quite big.
Then actually came the Eagles. The Eagles, which we've already dealt with. So
moving right.
Sorry
along.
About that, Bernie. Yeah.
Your history
right
man.
Along reminds me. It's one of Glenn's favourite expressions. You're always saying that.
What?
Next.
Oh yes, moving right along. Yes.
Or in your own time. Yeah. Or it'll be in the shops by Thursday. All right, well, the Eagles and then...
Now, the thing about a lot of these people that I'd come in contact with, as things moved along, I remained friends with some of the members of the bands, Bernie being one. And Bernie and I have worked on numerous projects since. Bless his heart, he's come all over the place and played on stuff with me. And that's just been... And there are several musicians like that. Andy Fairweather and Lowe is another one, who I used to use a lot. And so we formed little teams of camaraderie and musical taste, if you like. So it's just the great thing about my job. I mean, you can see, I can't get enough of it. I still now, I can't wait to get back in the studio when I finish talking about this bloody book. I mean, anybody who does what I do must feel the same. It's just the most brilliant job, and you get paid for it, if you're lucky. Or you get screwed, one or the other. But I mean, at least you've got the buzz of doing it, you know. Sorry, Paul.
Well, sadly, I don't think we're going to get through. Are we shooing us off? Yes, no, I don't blame you. I would have done it a long time ago. you know, what can we say? We whipped through McCartney and Wings, The Faces, the live Clapton album, and then you did your last Stones album, Black and
Blue. Slow hands. How long have we got here? Show me how many fingers. Do you want us to finish? No, I don't want to talk to these people.
Yeah, go on. They do that, and then
we should do
that. I can go out and have a fag.
But, okay, most of the stories, like a fag. Did you say? Buy the book for the rest of it because there's some pretty good stuff. I'd like to think there's some pretty good stuff. Some of it's very funny. I'd like to think, but
it's brilliant.
There's quite a lot more we haven't covered. So let's open it up to questions then. Yes, sir.
Mr. Johns, thank you very much. In your expert opinion, not technically the best drummer, but Keith Moon or John Bonham?
which was a better rock and roll drummer?
Oh. I get asked this a lot, actually, and obviously John Bonham is in a league of his own, and technically astonishing. Also, he created the most extraordinary sound. He knew how to tune his kit really well. Keith Moon, on the other hand, he had 900 drums, and he tuned them all the same pitch. He never thought about the pitch. He tuned them so that they were like biscuit tins, so that the stick bounced off easily, you know. But you can't compare them. I have as much respect for Keith as I do for John, but in different ways, and I feel the same way about lots of guitar players. And we talked about Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and Eric. They're all phenomenal at what they do, completely different, and I wouldn't say one was better than the other. They're just different. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Sir?
Why did you choose the roof for the Beatles?
Well, because the whole objective was to play live in front of an audience, and Ringo took me up on the roof to show me the view of the West End of London, and I thought, well, if you want an audience, why not play to the West End of London? And that's how it happened. And it became, once we mooted the idea, everybody thought it was quite funny, and the police station was 200 yards away, so we knew we wouldn't last very long. But that would make it all the more interesting for the film, because they had cameras set up in the street and one in the hallway of the building, so that when the police raided, to come in and stop us, we could film them. And so it was, you know, that's why. Next. Yes?
A lot of the studios that you worked at over the years don't exist anymore. Is there one that you miss working in?
Though, funnily enough, there isn't. I actually think change is as good as a rest. And some of the better records I've made, I can't think of any offhand, but when you're plonked down in a situation that you have that you're not familiar with, and obviously over the years I've been asked to work in places that I've never been before, so it's a bit of a challenge. You can get too comfortable if you work in the same place the whole time. I mean, obviously I was very comfortable in Olympic, where I made most of the records I made for a long time. And it did me great service. But that room in particular is incredibly flexible. You could do a 60-piece string section and get a wonderful sound, or you could do Jimi Hendrix, you know. I mean, it was incredibly...
Adaptable.
Thank you so much. Adaptable, yeah. Now I use Mark Knopfler's studio in London, which is called British Grove, which is the most extraordinary facility. But I don't know what it cost him, but it must have cost. It's a tax write-off. It would have to be. I'll never make any money out of it. It's a stunning place. A great studio, great equipment, great mics. In LA, I love Sunset Sound. There's a room at Sunset Sound that I just started using maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago now. That I used to work there a lot in the back room there. Are you familiar with Sunset Sound? And I've used both of the other two studios. And the shape of the third studio is a bit odd. And I mixed something in there a long time ago. As a favour to somebody, and I love the monitoring in there. Anyway, so now that's me. I made Ryan Adams, Ashes and Fire in there, and it's an astonishing sounding studio. You just lift the faders on, you don't you? Don't do anything. Next. Anyone else? Yes?
Could you walk us through the moments of the playing and recording of the opening riff of You Really Got Me? Because that's just...
If I could remember, I'd be happy to. However, I can't. I can remember sitting at the concert with it going on, but I don't remember any intimate detail. I also remember distinctly disliking Ray Davies and his brother enormously.
I remember asking about that, and I said, have you ever, you know, been making a record and feeling this was going to be a massive...
Oh, yeah, that was... Also, my generation. I mean, my generation was so different from anything I'd heard before as well. Imagine, you've got a bass solo in it for a start off, and then you've got Roger Daltrey singing with a stutter. I mean, extraordinary combination, but it worked, and it was a huge hit. Next, anybody? Yes?
I've mentioned Small Faces on your resume. Small Faces.
Yeah.
So did you engineer the song Itchy Coon Park?
Yes.
And that had like some fairly...
Phasing.
Fairly progressive phase shifting or something on it?
Phasing, yes.
Yeah, that was pretty advanced for that.
It was the first time it was used, I think, yeah. I only ever used it the once. I beg your pardon? A very catchy tune, yeah. Next, anybody? Yes, sir.
Were you at the first, when Jimi Hendrix played at the club in London, were you at that?
No.
Oh, you weren't?
No, funnily enough, I was never a big fan of Jimi Hendrix.
No, but you recorded him
at the Albert Hall. Well, I started to record him at the Albert Hall. The Albert Hall, in 1969, I was flown back from Los Angeles. I was working with Steve Miller, and the Beatles called,
And they actually paid for the whole band to stay in a hotel for a week while I went back to London to record.
Abbey Road?
No. I can't remember. A song, it doesn't matter. A song that John Lennon wrote. And I recorded, in that 3 days I was back, I did a session with the Stones, whatever this session was with the Beatles, and I was asked to record Jimi Hendrix at the Albert Hall. So I turned up, and in those days, the Albert Hall hadn't ever had any acoustic treatment done to it. It was as it was originally designed to be an acoustic hall, really. So it wasn't any good for loud rock and roll. It was completely useless. So I walked out on stage, having put my mics up, and Jimmy comes out, and I said, look, I know you're not going to take any notice, but you can't really play loud in here, because if you do, no one's going to hear a note you play. It's just going to be absurd. So I suggest you use half the rig that you've got now, at least, maybe even less. You can still crank it, but it'd just be quieter. So he was very sweet, very nice man. Completely ignored me, of course. And they had their sound check, and it was just absurd. You couldn't hear anything. Of course, there's no people in there, so that made it even worse. So when he came off, I went up to him and said, I'm telling you, it's never mind about the recording, but the audience aren't going to hear anything you're playing. They're paying money to see it and all that. So he was very sweet, very polite. Yeah, okay, well, fine. So, of course, doesn't take any notice again. So I'm set up in a dressing room with my assistant. And they walk out on stage, they play the first song, and it's exactly the same. It's just useless. So I went home. And I said to the assistant, just change the reels as they finish. I wasn't going to sit there and listen to it. It was just awful. And quite understandably, we never spoke to me again. So there you go. That's the end of that story. Next.
Glyn, let me just ask you to tell the audience briefly about the when you were helping your old and ailing friend, Ronnie Lane, and you very generously gave your time and effort to organising those mighty arms.
It was before Live Aid, so it was the first time a group of musicians that I knew about. Ronnie Lane had multiple sclerosis, bless his heart. And he went to Eric Clapton, who was a friend, and asked him if he would do a concert to raise some money to buy a hyperbaric oxygen unit, which apparently relieves the discomfort of multiple sclerosis. It doesn't cure it, but it does make you feel a bit better for a minute. And there was only one in the south of England or something, and Ronnie was trying to raise the money for another one. So Eric said, well, I tell you what, why don't we do a concert? So Eric then, of course, brings Muggins here, and says, well, all his band are in America. They're all Americans at this moment in time. He said, okay, Glyn, can you put a band together for us to do a concert to raise money for this thing for Ronnie? So I said, yeah, absolutely. So I called Stu up, the keyboard player with the Stones. I called Charlie Watts, Kenny Jones from the Faces, and Bill Wyman. And it's all coming together very nicely. Just I'm trying to get a rhythm section together. I thought two drummers might be nice, you know. Steve Winwood offers his services, bless him. A couple of nights later, Stu goes to a party at Jeff Beck's house. And Jimmy Page is there. And no one's seen Jimmy for a long time. The Led Zeppelin had collapsed. And not so Jimmy hadn't played for probably 3 or 4 years. Might have even been longer than that. And Jimmy makes a beeline for Jeff and says, look, Glyn's putting this band together to raise money for Ronnie with Eric. And Jimmy's ear-rolling this conversation. And so Jimmy says, I'll do it. So within 2 minutes, we had Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page. So there you've got three.
Eric Clapton.
And Eric Clapton. So you've got three of the greatest guitar players in the United Kingdom all on the same bill. So I thought, well, this is going to be a bit handy. So, and it sort of grew from that. I was turning people away. It was the most fun. And it was the first time I'd ever really realised that normally, all these people who are terribly popular and famous and wealthy and all the rest of it, they're a bit up their own bum. And they're not generous at all, and they're egotistical and all these things. And here we were in a situation where nobody pulled rank over anybody. They all came to my house. I had a little studio at my farm where I was working at the time. So we all rehearsed there for a week. It was fantastic. And it was all for Ronnie. And actually, Jimmy Page didn't really know Ronnie even particularly. So we did a concert for Prince Charles's Trust the previous night because Eric had an obligation, so we thought we might as well do that. And then we did the concert for Ronnie, and we raised an absolute fortune. And we had such a good time doing it, we brought it to America. Right. And it toured America, and it broke box office records everywhere we went. It was fantastic. It was really rewarding.
It was a wonderful thing for you to put together. Yeah. And I saw it there at the Albert Hall.
Yeah. It was a great night. It was a great night. Yeah.
I honestly think that we do have
to go. We have to go.
But what a career.
We're paying rent.
What a career. And a very sound man.